It's grown, but further south, there is some relief at least from the persistent rain, but it'll be a chilly day with nobody getting to double figures. For Northern Ireland, well, here again, sunny spells and showers, but again, around about the middle of the day, I think something a wee bit more persistent should afflict you. And for Scotland, well, we've got that low pressure close by. So for the Northern Isles, more persistent rain, perhaps turning a bit more showery later in the day. Eastern parts might get away with essentially a dry day, but out west, there will be further wintry showers on a noticeably cold day, and I'm afraid on Friday we are back to the same old routine with some very strong winds and a lot more rain. I wish you a peaceful night. Good night.
Thanks, Philip. We're now on Radio 4, the next instalment of our new book of the week, The Almost Nearly Perfect People, The Truth About the Nordic Miracle. The journalist Michael Booth leaves his adopted home of Denmark to continue his revealing journey through Scandinavia in a quest to uncover the secrets of its success. Along the way, a more nuanced, sometimes darker picture of the region emerges. Today, his attention turns to Norway, one of the richest countries in the world. The reader is Gunnar Kothry.
It's 2009, and the lawns of Slottsparken are packed with picnickers and partying Norwegians. The sky is an unblemished blue, and as always in Scandinavia, somehow higher seeming than any sky anywhere else in the world. Today, here in Oslo, we are basking in a rare alignment of good fortune. It is 17th May, 17th of May, Norwegian Constitution Day, and last night Norway, represented by a Minsk-born violinist singing a pathologically catchy song, put to rest the country's null-point nightmares of the past with a landslide victory at the Eurovision Song Contest. Oh, and let us not forget, these are the richest people on earth, which is quite a cherry. I have joined the crowds lining the streets of central Oslo to watch the annual parade of local schoolchildren meander through the city to the Royal Palace. This is the fancy dress party to end them all. Soon after leaving my hotel at 9 a.m, I begin to encounter them en masse. Men, women, children, and in some instances their pets, all decked out in regional costume. These include heavily embroidered dirndls, shawls, neckerchiefs and frock coats in black, red and green, shiny top hats, hobnail shoes with silver buckles, bright buttoned breeches, crisp white blouses with pirate sleeves, all of which eccentric get-up is collectively known as bunad. When the traditional parade of children passes, a good number of them ethnically non-Norwegian, I envied Norway. I envied its sense of togetherness, its unabashed pride, and, yes, the capes. There should be more capes in the world. At one point, a Somali girl passed by, struggling proudly with a flag three times her height, followed by a Sikh boy in authentic bunad. It was all I could do to suppress my tears. It wasn't just the fact of their ethnicity that had so touched me, but that the Somali, Turkish, Iraqi and Pakistani kids had committed just as fully to the Dungeons and Dragons aesthetic as their, in inverted commas, pure Norwegian peers. They too were proudly, unself-consciously dressed up in their Hobbit Sunday best. And it doesn't get much more assimilated than that. A little over 2 years later, a 32-year-old Oslo man, the racist extremist Anders Breivik, killed 77 people. 7 months later, I returned. From my seat in the bus, nothing appeared to have changed. What did I expect? Razor wire and police patrols? Hardly likely in a land where the then Prime Minister, at the memorial service to the dead of Utøya and the Oslo bomb, gave one of the most courageous speeches in defence of public freedom I had ever heard. The Norwegians had reacted to the attacks in various ways. Horror, obviously. Solidarity, mainly. Revulsion at Breivik's opinions, of course. But some felt there had been too much discussion of Breivik's mental state, and not enough about his views and the extent to which other Norwegians might agree with them. In September 2013, the right-wing Progress Party, of which Breivik was for many years an active member, won 16.3% of the vote in the parliamentary election. An electoral triumph that was enough to make it a partner in the new centre-right coalition government for the first time in its history. I went to see Sindre Bangstad, a social anthropologist who has specialised in studying Muslims in Norway. How much, I asked him, do Breivik's views represent those of ordinary Norwegians? Breivik claimed he had 35% of the Norwegian population on his side, but he's completely delusional about that, said Bangstad. There are, though, anti-Islamic websites, one of which claims to have 10,000 Facebook followers, although when they try to mobilise, only about 30-odd people turn up. Look, most Muslims are just like you and me. They want to live in peace with their neighbours. We've got very good research which shows that second-generation immigrants have been very much Norwegianised. They think like Protestants. When you look at the girls, they have replaced honour and shame with bad conscience, which is a very Protestant thing, and your relationship with God becomes an individual relationship instead of it going through the community. Actually, Protestants and Muslims very easily reach a common understanding because they find out that they have a lot in common in how they see the world in questions of the sexes, fidelity, and the idea that everything in this world is not random, that there is a transcendent mind behind things that gives life meaning. I always say this when people say to me, "Oh, you're just another of these multiculturalists who accepts everything, aren't you?" I say, "Well, no, but if you want to live in Norway, there are a couple of things you need to make peace with. One is the cold and the darkness. If you can't cope with it, then go somewhere else. And the other is the equality of the genders, because otherwise you're never going to be happy, because you will always feel there is something fundamentally wrong with Norway." I had to leave Oslo. I had begun to feel increasingly nauseous at the sight of Breivik's self-satisfied grin on the television screens and front pages every day. It was time to see something natural. When talking to Norwegians about their Norwegianness, time and again they would bring the conversation back to the special relationship they have with their landscape, to their love of the friluftsliv, or open-air life. This has always been a country of peasant farmers and fishermen, with a decentralised population. Norway has never looked to Oslo in the way that the Danes have to Copenhagen, or the Swedes to Stockholm. Denmark and Sweden have also reflected and defined themselves in and by each other, through their shared history of conflict and rivalry. But Norway has tended to mind its own business, separated by the great physical barriers of the mountains and the sea. This decentralisation, coupled with a heightened respect for their natural surroundings, are two of the keys to understanding the Norwegians. Still today, in Norway, people live out in the regions, way up north, in mountains, by the sea and on frozen islands. The contrast is striking when you cross from northern Norway to northern Sweden. On the Norwegian side, there will be small towns with shops, perhaps a takeaway, decent roads and civic buildings. On the other, nothing. In Norway, the right to live wherever you want is enshrined in law. It is part of a strategy to maintain the populations in the north of the country, particularly those close to the strategically vital territories of the Barents Sea and Spitsbergen. But to come to Norway and talk only of integration and immigration would be like visiting the Klondike in 1897 and preoccupying oneself with the plight of the Native Americans. The discovery in 1969 of what turned out to be gargantuan oil reserves in Norway's North Sea territories has shaped contemporary Norwegian society more than any other single factor. The success of modern Norway, of its welfare state, its virtually unparalleled standard of living, and its strong regional infrastructure, is to a great extent founded on oil. This country of just over 5 million people now has the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world. And I don't mean per capita. We're talking in absolutes. It overtook Abu Dhabi's when it hit $600 billion in 2011 and continues to rise. The fund currently stands at £395 billion, and is conservatively estimated to pass £1,000 billion before the end of the decade. They produce around 2 million barrels a day. Statoil is the largest company of any kind in the Nordic region in terms of revenue and its current record profits. And despite the perennial warnings that peak oil is imminent, and that the Norwegians will soon find themselves on the slippery slope back to the fish-drying, sheep-shearing dark ages, they keep discovering massive new reserves. Two gigantic puddles of the stuff containing up to a billion barrels worth were found in the Barents Sea in 2011. And now, with the ice cap conveniently melting, I wonder how that happened, the Norwegians also have the estimated 90 billion barrels of crude that lie beneath the Arctic in their beady sights. The oil fund is arguably modern Norway's greatest single achievement, the ultimate expression of Nordic self-discipline and control, and a paragon of responsible fiscal stewardship. This brilliantly managed, tightly controlled wealth fund is the envy of every oil-producing nation, not to mention every non-oil-producing nation, in the world. The man ultimately responsible for how that gigantic pot of gold is distributed around the globe is the CEO of Norwegian Bank Investment Management, Yngve Slyngstad. I went to see Slyngstad in his Master of the Universe eyrie in central Oslo. The fund owns shares in over 8,000 companies, which effectively means that Norwegians own over 1% of the world's listed companies, almost 2% of Europe's, and 0.7% of Asia's. How had the Norwegians managed to resist the temptation to spend their oil revenue, as Britain had in the 1980s, or some of the Arab states are doing so conspicuously at the moment? Traditionally, we've been a very poor country with a frugal consumption pattern, people living around the coasts, Yngve Slyngstad told me. Norway was not really part of Europe to the extent that there was no European-style feudal system. People lived independently, not in towns and villages. It is a country where, in the past, you didn't have enough to eat in winter unless you had saved it. So the Norwegians are mistrustful of indulgence or excess, ever conscious of the need to save and hoard. Yet, there's a downside to the oil, as the Norwegian author Simon Sætre points out. Norwegians are working 23% fewer hours per year than they were prior to the oil boom. He quotes an OECD report on Norway which stated that the country's oil wealth had distorted the relationship between work and free time. Perhaps the most troubling aspect of Norway's social structure is the fact that about a third of all Norwegians of working age do nothing at all. The picture is equally worrying for Norwegian children, who rank below the European average in terms of literacy, mathematics, and sciences, with the trend worsening over the last 10 years. Yngve Slyngstad concedes the point. Of course it's done something to us. My evidence is mostly anecdotal. Take the fish factories on the north coast. It's well paid, but hard, cold work, fish filleting. Most is now outsourced to China. The fish is flown to China, filleted, packaged in Findus boxes, and sent back. But the rest is done by Tamils and Russians, not Norwegians. Norwegians move to London or Paris to be something in the media. And that's a real sign of decadence. No one wants to work in a factory or be an engineer. Everybody wants to be famous. One tends to take the world for granted. Nothing is at stake. It doesn't really matter if I show up for work tomorrow. Things will chug on anyway. Sick leave is up and has been since the 90s. And not because people get more influenza, but because they feel it doesn't really matter.
Gunnar Kothry was reading The Almost Nearly Perfect People, The Truth About the Nordic Miracle by Michael Booth. The book was abridged by Richard Hamilton and produced by Gemma Jenkins. The Shipping Bulletin is next, but first to take us there, here's Sailing By. And now the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Thursday the 13th of February. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Bailey. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Scotland 955, expected Fair Isle 962 by 1800 Thursday. New low expected 550 miles west of Fitzroy 968 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Cirra, south at Cirra. Southeasterly, veering southerly 7 to severe gale 9. Rain or squally showers, moderate or poor. Forties, south, veering southwest 7 to severe gale 9. Occasionally storm 10 at first. Rain, then squally showers, moderate or good.